All right.
Sometimes less is more.
Yeah.
You heard that statement? Sometimes less is more. Yeah, like sometimes, Andrew's not going to like this, but sometimes quality food is better than a quantity of food. All right? Andrew has a vehement opposition to that idea. We've talked at length about this. But sometimes quality food is better than a quantity of food. Sometimes less is more. Sometimes music is beautiful because it's simplified. Or sometimes art is more moving because it's minimalistic. Right? Sometimes. Sometimes less is more. Sometimes my favorite podcasts or my favorite books or my favorite preachers are the ones who can just say the thing quickly and directly with less words. And I don't feel like there's a repetition and repeating. You're like, yeah, I got that. Like, can we move on? Sometimes less is more. Sometimes a simple, I love you or I'm sorry, even though they're only three words, can mean a ton when they come from a significant other, right? Sometimes less is more. So we have the book of Obadiah, right? The shortest book in the Old Testament. And it's less. There's only 21 verses in the entire book. But he's going to go narrow and deep with just a few words. In 21 verses, he's going to cut directly to the heart of what might be the primary issue in humans. Pride is where he goes with his few words. Like this idea that humans are prideful, this idea that all of us struggle with this. Humans 2,500 years ago, when Obadiah was preaching and writing poetry and these things, humans today, humans tomorrow are going to struggle with the huge topic of pride, and Obadiah is going to give us a few words that are important words, because sometimes less is more. Yeah? All right, so because it's only 21 verses, I'm going to break a little bit of our pattern for this series, and I'm not going to assume you've read it. I'm actually going to read it, although we did do that one other time, because I forgot to tell you what book we were in. But today, we're going to read the 21 verses of Obadiah, so if you want, pull out your Bible. It's about that far in, whatever Bible you're using. Or it's a click on a word that says Obadiah, which, by the way, was a name Nicole and I were considering for Elgin because I liked the nickname Obi, but we decided against it. We went with Elgin. This will also be on the screen if you don't want to look at a glowing rectangle in front of you, but on the wall, that's good too. All right, so the 21 verses of Obadiah, which is poetry from a prophet in the Old Testament. The vision of Obadiah. Thus says the Lord God concerning Edom. We have heard a report from the Lord, and a messenger has been sent among the nations. Rise up, let us rise against her for battle. Behold, I will make you small among the nations. And he's speaking to the nation of Edom. Keep that in mind throughout. Behold, I will make you small among the nations. You shall be utterly despised. The pride of your heart has deceived you. That's going to be a key idea for us today. You who live in the clefts of the rock in your lofty dwelling, who say in your heart, who will bring me down to the ground? Though you soar aloft like the eagle, though your nest is set among the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. If thieves came to you, if plunderers came by night, how you would have been destroyed. Would they not steal only enough for themselves? If grape gatherers came to you, would they not leave gleanings? How Esau has been pillaged, his treasures sought out. All your allies have driven you to your border. Those at peace with you have deceived you. They have prevailed against you. Those who eat your bread have set a trap beneath you. You have no understanding. Will I not on that day, declares the Lord, destroy the wise men out of Edom and understanding out of Mount Esau? And your mighty men shall be dismayed, O Teman, so that every man from Mount Esau will be cut off by slaughter. Because of the violence done to your brother Jacob, shame shall cover you, and you shall be cut off forever. On the day that you stood aloof, on the day that the strangers carried off his wealth, and foreigners entered his gates and cast lots for Jerusalem, you were like one of them. But do not gloat over the day of your brother in the day of his misfortune. Do not rejoice over the people of Judah in the day of their ruin. Do not boast in the day of distress. Do not enter the gate of my people in the day of their calamity. Do not gloat over his disaster in the day of his calamity. Do not loot his wealth in the day of his calamity. Do not stand at the crossroads to cut off his fugitives. Do not hand over his survivors in the day of distress. For the day of the Lord is near upon all the nations. As you have done, it shall be done to you. Your deeds shall return on your head, for as you have drunk on my holy mountain, so all the nations shall drink continually. They shall drink and swallow, and shall be as though they never had been. But in Mount Zion there shall be those who escape, and it shall be holy, and the house of Jacob shall possess their own possessions. The house of Jacob shall be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esau stubble. They shall burn them and consume them, and there shall be no survivor for the house of Esau, for the Lord has spoken. Those of the Negev shall pass Mount Esau, and those in the Shephelah shall possess the land of the Philistines. They shall possess the land of Ephraim and the land of Samaria, and Benjamin shall possess Gilead. The exiles of this host of the people of Israel shall possess the land of the Canaanites as far as Zarephath, and the exiles of Jerusalem who are in Sepharad shall possess the cities of the Negev. Saviors shall go up to Mount Zion to rule Mount Esau, and the kingdom shall be the Lord's. That's the 21 verses of Obadiah. Before I continue, let's watch the short video on the book.
The book of the prophet Obadiah. This is the shortest book in the whole Old Testament. It's a mere 21 verses. And at first glance, it does not look very promising. It's a series of divine judgment poems against the ancient people of Edom, which was a nation that neighbored Israel on the other side of the Dead Sea. However, there's way, way more going on. So, first, here's the backstory. The people of Edom were unique because they had a shared ancestry with the Israelites. They both belonged to the family of Abraham, who, with Sarah, had their son Isaac, who, with his wife Rebecca, had two sons, Jacob and Esau. Now, the book of Genesis told us the story of these two brothers, and to say the very least, they had a tense relationship. They each later received the names Israel and Edom, which eventually became the name of the families that descended from them. And these families replayed the same difficult relationship of their ancestors. Israel and Edom had enormous tensions throughout the centuries, but they still shared that family bond. And it's that bond that was betrayed and shattered in the tragic events of Jerusalem's fall to Babylon. So when Israel was invaded and conquered by Babylon, the people of Edom took advantage by plundering other Israelite cities and then capturing and even killing Israelite refugees. Now in other prophetic books, God held Israel's neighbors accountable for this kind of violence. And so here, Obadiah does the same for Edom. The short book has two halves. The first part is a series of accusations against the leaders of Edom, specifically for their pride and self-exaltation. Literally, as they lived up high in the desert rocks, but also metaphorically, they truly believed they were superior to the Israelites. And it's that pride that led the Edomites to not just stand idly by when Babylon came to destroy Jerusalem, but actually to participate in the destruction. And so God says through Obadiah that Edom will be brought down from their height and destroyed. As they have done to Israel, so it will be done to them. Now, right when you think you're going to hear more about how Edom will meet its doom, the topic suddenly shifts in verse 15. We hear this, "The day of the Lord is near against all nations." Now, why do we all of a sudden shift from Edom now to all nations? This verse is a hinge piece, and it links the first half of the book to the second half, where Obadiah announces the day of the Lord, but not only for Edom. He widens his focus to include all nations. And Obadiah says that all prideful nations that act like Edom will face God's justice in the same way. They'll fall from their prideful heights and come to ruin. Now the combination of these two sections, one about Edom, the other about all nations, shows us why Obadiah was so interested in this tiny southern neighbor of Israel. Obadiah sees Edom's pride and fall as an example, an image of how God will one day confront the pride of all nations and bring about their fall too. It's hardly coincidental that in Hebrew, the word Edom, or Edom, is spelled with the exact same letters as the word humanity, or in Hebrew, Adam. In Obadiah, Edom's rise and fall is a parable of how God's justice will one day oppose pride and violence among all nations in the day of the Lord. But as in all prophets, God's judgment is never his final word. Specifically, remember the conclusion of the two books that came right before Obadiah, Joel and Amos. Joel had painted a picture of what will happen after the day of the Lord against all nations. He said that God would perform a new act of salvation in Jerusalem, and that all who humbled themselves and called upon him would be delivered. And in the conclusion of Amos, he said that after the day of the Lord has judged Israel's people, God would raise up the house of David and build a new kingdom for Israel that would include Edom and all the nations called by my name. And so the book of Obadiah has been placed right after Joel and then Amos to expand on these very promises about the hope of God's kingdom over all of the nations. And so the book concludes with a very hopeful future. God says he's going to restore his kingdom over the new Jerusalem, that he'll repopulate it with a faithful remnant. And then from there, God's kingdom will expand to include all the territory and nations around Israel. And so this little book contributes to the larger portrait of God's justice and faithfulness that we're seeing in the prophets. The ancient pride and betrayal of the people of Edom becomes an example of the greater human condition, all of the ways that we betray and hurt each other in God's good world. But there's hope, Obadiah says. Edom's downfall points to the day when God will deal with evil in our world, but also bring his healing kingdom of peace over all the nations. And that's what the book of Obadiah is all about.
All right. Cool. So let's just jump right on in. One of the things that, right out of the gate, before I even give you the roadmap or anything, that I find really cool about this series through the Minor Prophets, that I'm not sure I saw before, was that God doesn't just speak to those who consider themselves God's people, right? So we've seen a couple times now that God he's speaking through the Minor Prophets, even to the surrounding nations. Like last week in the book of Nahum, we saw that he was speaking to the Ninevites, and in that God was revealing his characteristic of vengeance. This week, we're looking at the book of Obadiah, and he's speaking to the Edomites specifically. I find that fascinating, that God's word, he actually speaks to everybody. You know, he uses his people, but he actually has words for everybody. So that's just a side thing I find fascinating as I've been going through the Minor Prophets. To look at the book Obadiah, this word to the Edomites, where we'll see that the primary thing that God is exposing is human pride. Here's a roadmap of how I'll do this. Three things. We're going to look at the root of pride, and that's probably where I'm going to spend probably three quarters of our time. So this isn't going to be three equal parts, so as it gets, he's not off the first point yet. I'm not going to spend probably equal parts on all three. So the root of pride, then I want to look at the fruit of pride, and then I'm going to close. This doesn't actually jive in any kind of poetic way. Two kingdoms. That's the three ways that we'll look through the book. You with me? Lively today, yeah? All right. I actually think the video gives us some good background info, which I won't take a ton of time to walk back through. But as you can pick up from the video, as you may know from just being, if you've read the Bible and the Old Testament with some knowledge there, Edom and history have a storied, Edom and Israel, I'm sorry, have a storied history, right? It's the descendants of Jacob and Esau, which the video kind of pulled out. These are twin brothers who fought in the womb of their mother, Rachel. They fought in life. Their grandkids, their kids, their whole families, their descendants fought. Just picture family feuds that we know in history, like Hatfield and McCoys, right? Or this is just Scottish history, right? Like the clan war in Scotland is family feuds. It's the Montagues and the Capulets, right? If I go to literature with Romeo and Juliet, the list of family feuds that we can pull out from our own, it's just not a short list. And Israel and Edom are in that, this bitter generational feud. Jacob, also known as Israel, Esau, also known as Edom, all right? And so Edom, as Obadiah is drawing out, considered itself superior in two primary ways when you look through the first several verses of the book. The first is its dwelling place, or that it dwells in the cliffs. All right, so you guys familiar with Petra? And I don't mean Steve's favorite Christian rock band. I mean the ancient city in Middle East. You guys familiar with Petra from Indiana Jones? Which Indiana? Last Crusade? Last Crusade, yeah, right? So this is Petra, right? This is the city that is being referred to when he's talking about them dwelling in the cliffs with the security that's around them. So Edom had actually built itself into these cliffs. They built the city right into the mountains, and they had surrounding natural defenses where they thought themselves that they couldn't be overrun, they couldn't be overtaken. There was no way a military attack would actually bring their downfall based on the way the city was actually structured. They couldn't be conquered. This is what's in verse 3. If I was just to reread verse 3, the pride of your heart has deceived you. You who live in the clefts of the rock in your lofty dwelling, who say in your heart, who will bring me down to the ground? They had a false sense of security based on their very physical space that they occupied. That was the first thing. The second thing that they had pride in was their collective wisdom. Now, the Edomites, for a stretch of time, are actually a people known for their wisdom. If you look in other historical literature, if you look across other pieces of the Bible, the Edomites are known for their wisdom, or they're people who are sought out for their wisdom. I mean, even the engineering of the city in the cliffs is evidence a little bit of their, at least their engineering wisdom, if nothing else. And it's in these two things that Obadiah is putting his finger on quickly and saying in a few words that he's exposing their pride, that they have a false sense of security in that which they have built and that which in which they think, that they don't need God, or they've replaced their need for God by how they have progressed. All right? That is what Obadiah is speaking to the nation of Edom. Now, I think history has a way of repeating itself. Yeah? Like there's like a nation rises. It kind of comes up, it's born, it grows. It's even possibly used in mighty ways by God. Then we see that nation get proud. They start to try to expand their territory. They try to get their glory, their national glory around the world. And for whatever reason, because they think they've arrived, they think they've progressed and gotten to the best. People put their hope in its nation. They put their hope in its leaders. They put their hope in its ideals. But time and time again through history, each of these nations falls. Right, and is brought down. That's history 101 in cliff note form. Nations rise, nations get proud, nations put their hope in their nation, nation falls. Look, there's nothing new under the sun. And this is what Obadiah is calling out for the nation of Edom, that their pride in themselves will deceive them. This is a false sense of security that you have, a false comfort that you are leaning on. What you think to be wise will become foolish. All right, that's kind of the big picture that Obadiah is talking about. But then, as the video says, there's a hinge in the book where it says this is not just a word for Edom, but it's a word for all nations, right? All nations should actually pay attention to this. Right? Beware of nationalistic pride. It will deceive you. It won't save you. It won't comfort you. It can't be your security. And so is this not perhaps a poignant word for our time and our place? Right? Don't be deceived by nationalistic pride. You have false senses of security, a false sense of who you actually are. You have a false sense of your real wisdom. But see, here's the trick that I think we just kind of have to keep pressing into, is that what's true for communal pride is true because it's what's inside the individuals that make up that community. Right, so stuff like this, yes, it's a word to Edom. Yes, it's a word to all nations. But we have to go even further and actually say it's a word for us. Because we struggle with these things at a communal level because we make up the community. So pride is just something that root has taken root in our hearts that we need to be aware of. What's true for Edom is true for nations. It's true for all people and us individually. Pride will deceive us. And here's the other thing the Bible makes a repeated pattern of talking and telling us. God has a pattern of humbling the proud. Over and over and over and over again through the Bible, we are told this, that God brings down those who exalt themselves, that God makes lowly the proud, right? So in verse 4, I don't think these things are going to be on the screen, but in verse 4, when after he talks about them living in lofty dwellings, he says, I will bring you down. Like, this city will be destroyed. There'll be no security that you think you have. In verse 7, after he has a riff on what their elevated sense of wisdom, he tells him, you will end up with no understanding. Your wisdom will become foolishness. It cannot sustain you. And this is true for Edom, and it's true for us. From beginning to end, God humbles the proud. Because I think somewhere, if you're familiar with the seven deadly sins, and the greatest of those things is? Pride. Thanks, Elizabeth. You're on it. All right. I mean, maybe somebody else said it. I can't hear it. But I think the other thing that the Bible draws out from beginning to end is that pride is one of the significant root problems of our hearts, a core problem of our heart. There's a pastor in Philadelphia at the 10th Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia. I really like his writing. He's no longer alive. He's a pastor, I think, in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. He wrote a commentary on Obadiah, and there was this sentence in there, which I think is great. His name is James Montgomery Boyce. And if you ever podcast him, if you ever listen to his sermons on their website, what a voice. It's like, I don't know, just Wilford Brimley. It's like warm oatmeal cereal to your soul. But anyway, James Montgomery Boyce, he says this: "Nothing lies so much at the heart of the problems of the human race as the prideful desire to take over God's place, or, which amounts to nearly the same thing, to pretend that we can do without him." Right? This is a core fundamental problem of the human heart, pride. Psalms 10:4 just kind of says it plainly too. "In his pride, the wicked man does not seek him," meaning God. "In all his thoughts, there is no room for God." In his pride, there is no room for God, no room for thoughts from God. The root underneath so much of what we struggle with is our pride, our obsession with ourself. We can't get our eyes off ourselves. So I think we need to hear these stories, we need to hear these words, and not just read about history and hear how nations need to deal with national pride, but how we as individuals are prideful. And that's where I want to spend some time this morning, examining that question. Where are you prideful today? Where are you proud in your heart? And I mean in the negative kind of sense of that idea. Like where what are you just like clinging to for a false sense of security or a false sense of comfort that maybe you've built that you are proud of? Like we can't go past these things and just take it to our individual heart. Maybe as we say that, where are you proud today? Maybe there's a sense because the Spirit is just moving, like you've already got the conviction there. Like I know what's really going on underneath this sin struggle is really a prideful, self-centered heart. Maybe you don't, because I think this is often an area where we're really blind to. It's hard for us, I think, to be able to self-discern these things. So what I want to give you is maybe a few ways, a few thoughts, a few phrases that we may even say out loud or say internally that may expose a prideful, self-centered, arrogant, boastful perspective of ourselves. All right? Now, I got these all from Nicole's journal. All right? So we're that is not true. That'd be terrible. That's not true. That was a total joke. I got them from my own journal. Still a joke. All right, but does proud sound like this? Does proud come out in phrases that we think like this? They don't deserve that. Whatever that might be. I don't deserve this. I deserve better than this. I deserve that or this. Let me tell you why I'm right. I cannot, I will not have compassion for those people. I don't have time for them. I can't make space for who they are, how they think, how they look. I can't be around them. They are those people. I don't know, there's a lot of ways maybe we can keep exploring. This is not an exhaustive list. I would encourage you to think through how pride might be manifesting itself in your own heart. I think the big one in there might be like, I deserve this or I don't deserve this. There's so much sense of entitlement underneath those ideas. And I think we say them easily, especially in our culture. You deserve that. I don't deserve this. I don't know. I think we need to take the time to consider how much pride might actually be in underneath those thoughts. The other way I think we look at, and we just see pride manifest itself in the life of the Edomites specifically, as we read through there, did you catch the fact that as Israel was being ransacked by Babylon, or maybe you pick up in the video, that they actually took pleasure in it? That they celebrated the fall of their brother, their neighbor? There was a sense of like, ha, sucks to be you. Right, so sometimes, we can laugh maybe a little bit, but I wonder if this isn't even true of our own hearts, whether we say it out loud or whether we internalize it. I wonder what's underneath the "I told you so" statement. There's a little bit of "I'm right, and I told you so," and now there's a little bit of just kind of pleasure per se that we ended up being right, and that somebody else might be getting what they deserve at the end of the day. They made their bed, let them lie in it. Is there a heart of pride underneath that? They didn't help themselves. I offered to help them before, and now they're just reaping what they're sowing, so I'm out. And there's a lot of ways we can manifest itself. There's a lot of ways the root of pride can kind of expose itself in our hearts and want to keep us separate from the people around us. And I think it's well worth our time to slow the train down and examine our own individual hearts and what we say and what we do to figure out if there's a prideful heart underneath it. Edom trusted in its fortified city, didn't need to rely on God for security. Like as though God didn't make the cliffs that they were proud of. That idea, I think, what is it we've built that we just we're proud of? For security, is it our home? Is it our family? Is it our money? Like, what do we rely on for security as a false sense of something we're proud of that we've built? As though God doesn't own all those things. It didn't make all those things to begin with. None of those things will stand the test of time, but the thing to remember is that God will. Edom was proud of her wisdom, nor. As the Psalms would say, I think what we can pull out of this is in all of their thoughts, there was no room for God. They thought they had figured it out. They were the elders of their own mind, if I borrow language from Sean Rao, one of my favorite singers. Their opinion was the smartest, as though they even created their own ability to reason and think. Like, who gave them that ability? God. But yet they're proud of their own wisdom. So in your thinking and in your way of forming opinions, do you give room? Do you make room for God to have a say? To listen to Him, to hear from Him, for challenging, correcting words that you may reject that come from His word or come from His people. Like, see, pride doesn't allow yourself to be corrected. Like, if you're unwilling to be corrected by God's word or His people around you, pause and consider where you're being proud in your heart. And it's not even just for challenging and difficult words that might correct us, but sometimes we even dismiss and refuse comforting words that God's word may give to us or the people around us may try to encourage us with. And pride doesn't even allow us to hear those things rightly because we just have a false sense of ourselves. The essence is pride keeps us from seeing ourselves, like pride keeps us in the place of seeing ourselves as the most important thing. Pride keeps us in the place of saying my thoughts, my opinions, my voice is the most right. Or maybe, perhaps, the people right around me that I like, or like me, our voice is the most right. We can't see anything else, we can't hear anything else. Pride is what's underneath all that. So I want us to think, as the church who's meant to live a countercultural life, be different, think differently. Do we make room for God to actually weigh in on our thoughts and opinions, individually and collectively, with truth and with grace? Like, I think this stuff needs to continually call us to be humble. Right? Not in our own wisdom, but in the wisdom of the Lord. That his ideas reign more true than our thoughts or our opinions. That His provision is more comforting and more secure than anything we can acquire or build ourselves. It's to let go of these things. Stop clinging to these things so that we can cling to Him a bit more. Like, the book packs a short punch. It doesn't really get into a lot of the detail. It just puts its finger on an issue and then calls us to lean into it. And it's an issue that's a fundamental problem with us, that we have to dig up this root of pride in our lives. And if pride is the core problem, then can I propose humility to be the core solution? Right? Like, I don't want us to confuse here. Like, humility is not thinking less of yourself. It's thinking of yourself less. And I think that's an important thing for us to navigate here. And I'm saying, like berate yourself. Like, humbleness doesn't mean, like, to, like, beat yourself down and think less of yourself. It's to think of yourself less and to think of others more. Think of God more. There's a fundamental difference in that perspective of what humility is. So my encouragement for you all this week, is coming out of this, is to ask yourself, where is pride in my heart, in my mind, in my life right now? Take the time to get pen and paper to start listing out some things. Journal on this. Pray about it. Read the Bible specifically asking and like praying to God to like give me something here. Like, if I can read the Bible looking for this, ask God this. Where is my heart prideful? And see what He may say. And invite a trusted soul friend on this journey. I think this is an area where we have a really hard time seeing ourselves rightly. We have blind spots all over the place as to where we are proud. An overinflated sense of ourself. And in that moment with a trusted friend, have the humility to just listen and not rush to defend yourself. Man, that's hard to do. Like, I'm really examining my own life as I give you these words. Like, just humility will listen to a friend who we trust and who we think loves us and not rush to defend ourselves. And can I invite you guys to take up that journey this week? The Lord has a pattern of humbling those who exalt themselves. And pride is just deeply rooted in our hearts. But it's not just that. I mean, it's there, but I think what Obadiah does is actually kind of brilliant in his poetry, because there's something else he does here. Like, he's clear that the core problem, the underlying problem, the first thing he addresses is pride, but then he kind of goes further. He doesn't just keep telling them that they're proud. He actually calls out the way that their pride bore fruit of sin. Right, so I think this is an important thing for us to see as he's journeying through, how the root of their pride actually bore the fruit of wrong action against not only their fellow humans, but like their actual brothers in this Jacob and Esau generational feud. Like, the scenario that Obadiah is addressing here, that the video draws out, is that Jerusalem is attacked by Babylon, right? And they're carried off. And this is like what the reaction to that is, everything that Obadiah unpacks. And here's how it starts when they're attacked, and when Israel is attacked and carried off into exile. First, and this is probably verses, I think, I want to guess here, I'm not going to reread it. I'm going to say 7 through 14, I think, is where all these things are in the verses. But the first thing that he calls out the Edomites for doing is that they did nothing, actually. They stood by and watched. They didn't do anything. They didn't say anything in the face of violence and oppression and injustice being carried out on their neighbor. They actually did nothing. That was the first thing Obadiah picks out. Then they gloated over their fall. Like, Esau or Edomites had this idea that they deserved it. They had it coming. Then they didn't just gloat over it. They actually rejoiced in it. They found pleasure in the downfall of their brothers. They're not as strong or as wise as us. And then it's not even just that they stood back and did nothing or celebrated this after the fact. We actually get to the point by the end of the verses where they're actually taking part in the oppression. We're told that they loot, they pillage, they raid Jerusalem. We're actually told as Israelites are fleeing from the Babylonians, they're capturing them and then handing them back to the people. Like, they're actually taking part in the oppression. And we're told by the very end that they actually slay some of the Israelites as well, too. Like, they move through this whole progression. What started as pride for years, a root of pride towards their brother, started to bear the fruit into indifference, into silence, which grew into boasting, which grew into haughtiness, which grew into celebrating the suffering of their neighbor, which then grew into thievery, oppression, and even got to the place of murder. Pride is a painful root in our hearts. And it bears the fruit of so many other things in time. We can't be caught unaware of this in us too, that our outward sins don't happen overnight. Right? Like, these things are often fed and fueled. Like, the actions of our hands are often fed and fueled. They're preceded by what we're thinking and what we're feeling inside. Are the big outward sins have seeds of little protected sins that we won't let go of. Like, capture that progression. I think it's really important for us to see this. Because often we find all the rage at the outward actions of injustice and oppression and forget the root underneath all those things that over time actually gave rise to those things. Like, I think we need to be reminded of this and hear this, that the outward sin that we struggle with is likely preceded by a pride that we are very strong in. That's hard for us, I think, to hear, and hard for us to even like identify at times, because like I said before, I think we're even blind to this. But pride is like underneath so many things. Pride preceded Satan's fall. Pride preceded Adam's and Eve, who wanted to know and be like God. Pride preceded David's affair with Bathsheba. He didn't deserve to be at war. He deserved to satisfy his desires. Pride preceded Adam's like perspective in their actions or inactions against their brother. Pride preceded so many things. The same is true for us. Right? What is pride giving fuel to in your life? Under the sin that you are struggling with and dealing with, is it possible there's a prideful, arrogant, isolated, haughty heart that you don't want to let go of, and you don't want to admit, and you don't want to let others into? That's the root that needs to be dealt with. And it's hard, right? Because I don't want to propose just a try harder, do better, put a band-aid on it. This is actually a significant thing to get to the root of pride. Let me just press back in here. You will need community help in order to take on this journey. You can't do this yourself. Because one, you really won't want to. We hold on to it. Because the sins that we struggle with is likely fueled by a pride that we are actually strong with and don't want to acknowledge or admit. But that's what we need to get after as a community following Christ. Which begs the question, right? Like, begs the question, how do we, as people, with a natural, prideful heart that we're told the Lord will humble, right? The Lord will humble those who are proud. So we have this natural, prideful heart. And but how do we actually transform that into a humble, a lowly, a meek heart that the Lord will actually exalt? How do we, can we actually do the work of transforming a prideful heart into a humble heart? And I think that's a brilliant question that we have to give. And it's a needed answer. And I think the final words of the book of Obadiah actually seem to me to clue us into something here. This is, again, few words, but I think if we really lay claim to what these words mean, these are really important. The final words of Obadiah. I think it's on the screen, isn't it? The kingdom shall be the Lord's. Like, I actually think there's a connection here. The kingdom will be the Lord's. And this is kind of the answer to my question. Like, how can we, if it's possible, and let me just give you a spoiler alert and say, I'm going to get to the point where I say, it's not possible for you to transform your own heart. Right? This phrase is going to lead us on a little bit of a journey, right? The kingdom shall be the Lord's. The Edomite kingdom, the Jewish kingdom, the Babylonian kingdom, the Greek kingdom, the Chinese kingdom, the Mongolian kingdom, the American kingdom, the British kingdom. All of the kingdoms are the Lord's. Let's start there. Right? All of these things are the Lord. All of your life, all of my life is the Lord's. The way that we are, the breath in our lungs, the resources we have, the way that we think, all of these things, our collective wisdom, all of this stuff is the Lord. At the end of the day, as I started with earlier, we own none of these things. All of these things are the Lord. All of nature is His. And all of these kingdoms that we may strive to build, to progress, like, these things all belong to Him. Like, I don't know as if we actually live that thought out to its fullest extent. That ultimately God reigns and God is king. And I think this is a brilliant reality check for the pride of our hearts. Is that all things fall under the reign of His kingdom. We actually reign over, let me just say it, nothing. We reign over nothing. All things are His. He's king. Okay. Let's go back to Isaac and Jacob. Or Isaac and Esau when they were born. Here's the prophecy we get from the Lord to Rachel in Genesis 25, verse 23. Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. This is the prophecy the Lord gave Rachel. Do I have the right mother in my Bible stories? I think I do. Nicole, am I right? Yeah, we're good. This is the prophecy the Lord gave the mother. We'll go with that. Of Isaac and Esau. Jacob and Esau. What am I doing? Isaac was the dad. I'm terrible. I'm the worst, as Elizabeth would say. But the prophecy is this, right? That the battle from these two sons would rage on from these two. Like, as if we just progress, if we just actually pulled this thread through the Old Testament, you're going to see this a number of times. Moses is delivering the people out of Egypt. He's traveling to the promised land. He wants to cross through Edomite territory. He asks for permission, and they say, no, we don't like you. And they don't let him pass. Right? We see in David, if you follow the Kings and the Chronicles and 1 and 2 Samuel and all the historical books, David, over and over again, is fighting battles with Edom. Obadiah is about this family feud. Like, this is actually a family feud you see pop up over and over and over again through the Old Testament. Israel and Edom. But there's another time that I think we need to skip ahead to, for when there's two kings from the same line of Edom and Israel who confront each other. And this is fascinating. This is one of the reasons why I just find the Bible beautiful. Like, why I find it sacred, why I find it just awesome, is because at one glance, we could step back and think there's all of these authors talking about all of these things. But then over the time, as you read the whole of it, you start to realize, wait a minute, there's actually consistent threads through all of this. Maybe it's not 44 different authors writing the book. Maybe there's actually one author behind those people writing a book and actually pulling together the stuff that we may say happens over hundreds of years. And God's just like, yeah, I got it all. But late in the New Testament, right? Like, after we get Obadiah written, centuries later, there's two kings standing before each other again. So, catch this. King Herod the Great, an Edomite. From Edom. The king who slaughtered innocents trying to rid the coming king of the Jews that he heard about. Right? He was an Edomite. So his son, King Herod Antipas, is the Herod that the other king, right, Jesus Christ, is standing back and forth, and he's asking him, are you the king of the Jews, and what is truth? This is an Edomite and an Israelite. This stuff is beautiful, I think, if we step back and catch the narrative of these things. That these two kings, one who's arrayed in power, one who's arrayed in pride, one who's arrayed in wealth, but is still searching for truth. At the end of the day, he doesn't really have much. He has the power to control people, sure, but he also has an earthly kingdom that will fail, and across from him is another king in a robe. He's beaten, he's humiliated, and he has all the wisdom, all the truth, and he has the power to transform people, not just control people. These are two radically different kings standing in front of each other. One is going to be a king that's going to reign forever, and Jesus' response to his king is like, my kingdom is not of this world. Right? And this is the King Jesus who's about to be crowned the sovereign Lord over all because he becomes the servant for all. Like, this is fabulous story writing. So listen, likewise, within you, there's two kingdoms at war. Like, get this about yourself. The prophecy that was true for the mother, I'm not even trying to go back through the names, you have two kingdoms at war within you. Right? The kingdom of yourself, over which you reign, that will deceive you. Or the kingdom of your Savior, who has real reign. These are the two kingdoms within yourself battling for your soul. And that the king of your heart, as prideful as it may be, is Jesus Christ. And he bids you come and die. Give up the lordship of your own life for his loving leadership of your life. It's the core of the gospel. Humble yourself. You don't own your life. You don't own your soul. There's nothing you can do to save yourself. None of these things. Anything that you may hope for in salvation is a false sense of security. Your pride in that will deceive you. It's this King, Jesus Christ, who can transform your heart. When you yield, when you finally give up, when you finally say, I have no kingdom, the kingdom is yours, do with me what you want. That's the place. That's the stuff that, rather than bear the fruit of what we see in Edom, that will be the thing that transforms our heart and bears the fruit of humility, bears the fruit of patience, gentleness, peace, kindness, forgiveness. But it starts here. Allowing the Lord, Jesus Christ, to reign over your heart and your soul. Let's pray.